And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading, and we've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott, and we're getting very close to the end of it. Start looking around for something else to read, I think. But before we continue on, a word from the people who help make our station possible.
For all your septic needs, give our sponsor Braidwood Septic Services a call.
They're fully licensed and insured and are a Braidwood-based family-owned and operated company.
They carry out septic pump-outs, vacuum loadings, grease trap pump-outs and septic installation and repairs. Braidwood Septic Services on 0438 564 015
or 0400 400 251.
JG Earthworks is your one-stop shop for all your excavation needs. From big to small, Joel and his team will do it all. Landscaping, backyard cleanups, roadworks and driveway, site cleaning and levelling, dam cleaning and construction, motocross and supercross tracks. Check out his website at www.jgearthworks.com to get a full view of services available. Or call Joel on 0406 869 618 for a free quote and expert advice. Let JG Earthworks do your dirty work. JG Earthworks, proud supporter of Braidwood FM.
At Nutrien Ag Braidwood, we offer a wide range of services. Along with rural merchandise, we handle your livestock and wool sales. Our business has been part of Braidwood for over 20 years, and between us we share over 100 years of knowledge in rural services. We actively support local sports clubs and volunteer organisations. It's part of being in the community. Nutrien Ag Braidwood, rural merchandise right here. Call 4842 2405.
Supporting Braidwood FM 88.9. Specialising in rural conveyancing and succession planning, Chamberlain's Law Firm are with you for all your legal needs. No matter how big or small, their lawyers can assist with a range of legal problems and advice. With offices in Braidwood, Canberra and Sydney, they have team members everywhere to assist you. Call Chamberlain's today on 6188 6200 or find them online at chamberlains.com.au to speak with their expert lawyers about your legal needs. Chamberlain's Law Firm, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors who help our station to continue on its way. Well, we're at the point where the black champion, Sir Fetterlock, is riding with Wamba, the jester, on their way to Koningsberg for the funeral of Athelstan. At the point of their journey at which we take them up, this joyous pair were engaged in singing a virale, as it was called, in which the clown bore a mellow burden to the better instructed knight of the Fetterlock. And this is how the ditty ran. Anne Marie, love up is the sun. Anna Marie, love morn is begun. Mists are dispersing, love birds singing free. Up in the morning, love Anna Marie. Anna Marie, love up in the morn. The hunter is winding, blithe sounds on his horn. The echo rings merry from rock and from tree. 'Tis time to arouse thee, love Anna Marie. And Wamba went. O Tybalt, love Tybalt, awake me not yet. Around my soft pillow while softer dreams flit. For what are the joys that in waking we prove compared with these visions, O Tybalt, my love? Let the birds to the rise of the mist carol shrill. Let the hunter blow out his loud horn on the hill. Softer sounds, softer pleasures in slumber I prove. But think not I dreamed of thee, Tybalt, my love. A dainty song, said Wamba, when they had finished their carol. And I swear by my bauble a pretty moral. I used to sing it with Garth, once my playfellow, and now, by the grace of God and his master, no less than a free man. And we once came by the cudgel for being so entranced by the melody that we lay in bed 2 hours after sunrise, singing the ditty, between sleeping and waking. My bones ache at thinking of the tune ever since. Nevertheless, I have played the part of Anna Marie to please you, fair sir. The jester next struck into another carol, a sort of comic ditty, to which the knight, catching up the tune, replied in the like manner. Together they sang. There came three merry men from south, west and north, evermore sing the roundelay, to win the widow of Wycom forth, and where was the widow that might say them nay? The first was a knight, and from Tyndale he came, evermore sing the roundelay, and his fathers, God save us, were men of great fame, and where was the widow might say him nay? Of his father the laird, of his uncle the squire, he boasted in rhyme and in roundelay. She bade him go bask by his sea-coal fire, for she was the widow, and she would say him nay. Womba then sang, "The next that came forth swore by blood and by nails, merrily sing the roundelay. Hers a gentleman got what, and hers lineage was of Wales, and where was the widow that might say him nay? Sir David, ap Morgan, ap Griffith, ap Hugh, ap Tudor, ap Rice," quoth his roundelay. She said that one widow for so many was too few, and she bade the Welshman wend his way. But then next came a yeoman of Kent, jollily singing his roundelay. He spoke to the widow of living and rent. And where was the widow who would say him nay? And then they both sang together. So the knight and the squire were both left in the mire, therefore to sing their roundelay. For a yeoman of Kent with his yearly rent, there never was a widow could say him nay. "I would," said the knight, "that our host of the Trysting Tree, or the jolly friar, his chaplain, heard this thy ditty in praise of our bluff yeoman."
"So would I, no, not I," said Womba,
"for the horn that hangs at your baldric."
"Aye," said the knight, "this is the pledge of Locksley's goodwill, though I am not like to need it. 3 motts on this bugle will, I am assured, bring round at our need a jolly band of yonder honest yeomen."
"I would say heaven forfend," said the jester, "were it not that the fair gift is a pledge, they would let us pass peaceably."
"Why, what mean you?" said the knight. "Think you that but for this pledge of fellowship they would assault us?"
"Oh, nay, nay, for me I say nothing," said Womba, "for green trees have ears as well as stone walls. But can you construe me this, sir knight? When is thy wine pitcher and your purse better empty than full?"
"Why, never, I think," replied the knight.
"Ah, you never deserve to have a full one in your hand for so simple an answer. You had better empty your pitcher before you pass it to a Saxon, and leave your money at home before you walk in the greenwood."
"You hold our friends for robbers, then," said the knight of the Fetterlock.
"You hear me not say so, fair sir," said Womba. "It may relieve a poor man's steed to take off his mail when he has a long journey to make, and certainly it may do good to the rider's soul to ease him of that which is the root of all evil. Therefore will I give no hard names to those who do such services. Only I would wish my mail at home and my purse in my chamber when I meet these good fellows, because it may save them some trouble."
"We are bound to pray for them, my friend, notwithstanding the fair character you do afford them."
"Oh, pray for them with all my heart," said Womba, "but in the town, not in the greenwood, like the abbot of St. Bees, whom they caused to say mass within an old hollow oak tree for his stall."
"Say as you wish, Womba," replied the knight. "These yeomen did your master Cedric yeomanly service at Torkelston."
"Aye, truly," answered Womba, "but that was in the fashion of their trade with heaven."
"Their trade? Womba, what do you mean by that?" replied his companion.
"Well, this," said the jester, "they make up a balanced account with heaven, as our old cellarer used to call his ciphering, and as fair as Isaac the Jew keeps with his debtors, and like him give out a very little and take large credit for doing so, reckoning doubtless on their own behalf the sevenfold usury which the blessed text has promised to charitable loans."
"Give me an example of your meaning, Womba. I know nothing of ciphers or rates of usage," answered the knight.
"Why," said Womba, "and on your valour be so dull, you will be pleased to learn that these honest fellows balance a good deed with one not quite so laudable, as a crown given to a begging friar with 100 byzants taken from a fat abbot, or a wench kissed in the greenwood with the relief of a poor widow."
Which of these was the good deed, which was the felony?" interrupted the knight.
"Oh, a good jibe," said Womba. "Oh, keeping witty company sharpens the apprehension. You said nothing so well, sir knight. I will be sworn when you held drunken vespers with the bluff hermit. But to go on. The merry men of the forest set off the building of a cottage with the burning of a castle, the thatching of a choir against the robbing of a church, the setting free of a poor prisoner against the murder of a proud sheriff. Or, to come nearer to our point, the deliverance of a Saxon franklin against the burning alive of a Norman baron. Gentle thieves they are, in short, and courteous robbers,
but it is ever the luckiest to meet them when they are at the worst.
How so, Womba? Said the knight.
Why, then they have some compunction enough for making up matters with heaven. But when they have struck an even balance, heaven help them with whom they next open the account. The travellers who first met them after their good service at Torkelston would have had a woeful flaying. And yet, said Womba, coming close up to the knight's side, there be companions who are far more dangerous for travellers to meet than yonder outlaws.
And who may they be? For you have neither bears nor wolves, I bet, said the knight.
Oh, sir, yes, but we have Malvoisin's men-at-arms, said Womba, and let me tell you that in time of civil war, a half-score of these is worth a band of wolves at any time. They are now expecting their harvest and are reinforced with the soldiers that escaped from Torkelston, so that should we meet with a band of them, we are like to pay for our feats of arms. Now, I pray you, sir knight, what would you do if we met two of them?
Pin the villains to the earth with my lance, Womba, if they offered us any impediment.
But what if there were four of them?
They should drink from the same cup, answered the knight.
What if six? Continued Womba. And as we now are barely two, would you not remember Locksley's horn?
What? Sound for aid? Exclaimed the knight. Against a score of such rascals as these, whom one good knight could drive before him as the wind drives the withered leaves?
Oh, nay then, said Womba, I will pray you for a close sight of that same horn that has proved so powerful a breath.
The knight undid the clasp of the baldric and indulged his fellow traveller, who immediately hung the bugle around his own neck.
Tra-li-ra-la, said he, whistling the notes. Nay, I know my gamut as well as another.
How mean you, knave? Said the knight. Restore me the bugle.
Oh, content you, sir knight, it is in safe-keeping. When valour and folly travel, folly should bear the horn because she can blow the best.
Ah, rogue, said the black knight. This exceeds your licence. Beware, you tamper not with my patience.
Oh, urge me not with violence, sir knight, said the jester, keeping at a distance from the impatient champion. Or folly will show a clean pair of heels and leave valour to find his own way through the wood as best he may.
No. All right, you have hit me there, said the knight. And, yes, all right, I have little time to jangle with you. Keep the horn, as you will, but let us proceed on our journey.
You will not harm me, then, said Womba.
I tell you no, knave.
But pledge me your knightly word on it, continued Womba as he approached with great caution.
My knightly word I pledge. Only come on with your foolish self.
Oh, nay, then, valour and folly are once more boon companions, said the jester, coming up frankly to the knight's side. But in truth I love not such buffets as that you bestowed on the burly friar when his holiness rolled on the green like a king of the ninepins. And now that folly wears the horn, let valour rouse himself and shake his mane, for if I mistake not, there are company in yonder brake that are on the lookout for us.
What makes you judge so? Said the knight.
Well, because I have twice or three times noticed the glance of a morion from amongst the green leaves. Had they been honest men, they kept to the path, but yonder thicket is a choice chapel for the clerks of St. Nicholas.
By my faith, said the knight, closing his visor, I think you be on the right of it. And in good time did he close it, for three arrows flew at the same instant from the suspected spot against his head and breast, one of which would have penetrated to the brain had it not been turned aside by the steel visor. The other two were averted by the gorget and by the shield which hung around his neck. "Thanks, trusty armourer," said the knight. "Womba, let us get close with them." And he rode straight to the thicket, where he was met by six or seven men-at-arms, who ran against him with their lances at full career. Three of the weapons struck against him and splintered with as little effect as if they had been driven against a tower of steel. The black knight's eyes seemed to flash fire, even through the aperture of his visor. He raised himself in his stirrups with an air of inexpressible dignity and exclaimed, "What means this, my masters?" The men made no other reply than by drawing their swords and attacking him on every side. "Die, tyrant!" "Ha! St. Edward!" "Ha! St. George!" said the black knight, striking down a man at every invocation. "Have we traitors here?" His opponents, desperate as they were, bore back from an arm which carried death in every blow, and it seemed as if the terror of his single strength was about to gain the battle against such odds when a knight in blue armour, who had hitherto kept himself behind the other assailants, spurred forward with his lance, and taking aim not at the rider, but at the steed, wounded the noble animal mortally. "That was a felon stroke!" exclaimed the Black Knight as the steed fell to the earth, bearing his rider with him. And at this moment Wamba wound the bugle and blew, for the hole had passed so speedily that he had no time to do so sooner. The sudden sound made the murderers bear back once more, and Wamba, though so imperfectly weaponed, did not hesitate to rush in and assist the Black Knight to rise. "Shame! Shame on you, you false cowards!" exclaimed he in the blue harness, who seemed to lead the assailants. "Do you fly from an empty blast of a horn blown by a jester?" Animated by his words, they attacked the Black Knight anew, whose best refuge was now to place his back against an oak and to defend himself with his sword. The felon knight, who had taken another spear, watched the moment when his formidable antagonist was most closely pressed, galloped against him in hopes to nail him with his lance against the tree, when his purpose was again interrupted by Wamba. The jester, making up by agility the want of strength, and little noticed by the men-at-arms who were busied with their more important object, hovered on the skirts of the fight, and effectually checked the fatal career of the Blue Knight by hamstringing his horse with a stroke of his sword. Horse and man went to the ground, yet the situation of the Knight of the Fetterlock continued very precarious as he was pressed close by several men, completely armed, and began to be fatigued by the violent exertions necessary to defend himself on so many points at nearly the same moment when a grey goose shaft suddenly stretched on the earth one of the most formidable of his assailants, and a band of yeomen broke forth from the glade, headed by Locksley and the jovial friar, who, taking ready and effectual part in the fray, soon disposed of the ruffians, all of whom lay dead on the spot or mortally wounded. The Black Knight thanked his deliverers with a dignity they had not observed in his former bearing, which hitherto had seemed rather that of a blunt soldier than a person of exalted rank. "It concerns me much," he said, "even before I express my full gratitude to my ready friends, to discover that I may, who have been my unprovoked enemies, open the visor of the Blue Knight, Wamba, who seems to be the chief of these villains." The jester instantly made up to the leader of the assassins, who, bruised by his fall and entangled under the wounded steed, lay incapable either of flight or of resistance. "Come, valiant sir," said Wamba, "I must be your armourer as well as your equerry. I have dismounted you, and now I will unhelm you." So saying, with no very gentle hand, he undid the helmet of the Blue Knight, which, rolling to a distance on the grass, displayed to the Knight of the Fetterlock grizzled locks and a countenance he did not expect to have seen under such circumstances. "Voldemar Fitzurse," he said in astonishment, "what could urge one of your rank and seeming worth to so foul an undertaking?" "Richard," said the captive knight, looking up at him, "you know little of mankind if you know not what ambition and revenge can lead every child of Anab to." "Revenge?" answered the Black Knight. "I never wronged you. On me you have nothing. You have nothing to revenge. My daughter, Richard, whose alliance you scorned, was that no injury to a Norman whose blood is as noble as your own?" "Your daughter," replied the Black Knight, "a proper cause of enmity and followed up to a bloody issue. Stand back, my masters, I would speak to him alone. And now, Waldemar Fitzurse, say me the truth. Confess who set you on this traitorous deed." "Your father's son," answered Waldemar, "who in so doing did but avenge on you the disobedience you showed to your father." Richard's eyes sparkled with indignation, but his better nature overcame it. He pressed his hand against his brow and remained an instant, gazing on the face of the humbled baron in whose features pride was contending with shame. "You do not ask your life, Waldemar," said the king. "He that is in the lion's clutch," answered Fitzurse, "knows it is needless." "Well, take it then, unasked," The lion preys not on prostrate carcasses. Take your life, but with this condition, that in 3 days you will leave England and go to hide your infamy in your Norman castle, and you will never mention the name of John of Anjou as connected with this felony. If you are found on English ground after the space I have allotted to you, you die. Or if you breathe anything that can attaint the honour of my house, by St. George, not the altar itself will be a sanctuary for you. I will hang you out to feed the ravens from the very pinnacle of your own castle. Let this knight have a steed, Locksley, for I see your yeomen have caught those which were running loose. Let him depart unharmed. But that, I judge, I listen to a voice whose behests must not be disputed, answered the yeoman. I would send a shaft after the skulking villain. That should spare him the labour of a long journey. You bear an English heart, Locksley, said the Black Knight. And well do you judge. You are more bound to obey my behest. I am Richard of England, Coeur de Lion. At these words, pronounced in a tone of majesty suited to the high rank and no less distinguished character of Coeur de Lion, the yeomen at once kneeled down before him, and at the same time tendered their allegiance and implored pardon for their offence. Rise, my friends, said Richard in a gracious tone, looking on them with a countenance in which his habitual good humour had already conquered the blaze of hasty resentment, and whose features retained no mark of the late desperate conflict, except the flush arising from exertion. Arise, he said, my friends. Your misdemeanours, whether in the forest or field, have been atoned by the loyal services you rendered my distressed subjects before the walls of Torquilston, and the rescue you have this day afforded to your sovereign. Arise, my liegemen, and be good subjects in future, and you, brave Locksley. Call me no longer Locksley, my liege, but know me under the name which I fear fame has blown too widely not to have reached even your ears. I am Robin Hood of Sherwood Forest. King of outlaws and prince of good fellows, said the king, who has not heard a name that has been borne as far as Palestine? But be assured, brave outlaw, that no deed done in our absence and in the turbulent times to which it has given rise shall be remembered to your disadvantage. True, says the proverb, said Wamba, interposing his word, but with some abatement of his usual petulance, when the cat is away, the mice will play. What, Wamba, are you there? Said Richard. I have been so long of hearing your voice, I thought you'd taken flight. I take flight? Said Wamba. When do you ever find folly separated from valour? There lies the trophy of my sword, that good grey gelding, whom I heartily wish upon his legs again, conditioning his master lay there, howled in his place. It is true I gave a little ground at first, for a motley jacket does not brook lanceheads, as a steel doublet will. But if I fought not at sword's point, you will grant me that I sounded the onset. Yes, and to good purpose, honest Wamba, replied the king. Your good service shall not be forgotten. Confiteor, confiteor! Exclaimed in a submissive tone a voice near the king's side. My Latin will carry me no farther, but I confess my deadly treason and pray leave to have absolution before I am led to execution. Richard looked around and beheld the jovial friar on his knees, telling his rosary while his quarterstaff, which had not been idle during the skirmish, lay on the grass beside him. His countenance was gathered so as he thought might be best to express profound contrition, his eyes being turned up and the corners of his mouth drawn down, as Wamba expressed it, like the tassels at the mouth of a purse. Yet this demure affectation of extreme penitence was whimsically belied by a ludicrous meaning which lurked in his huge features and seemed to pronounce his fear and repentance alike hypocritical. "For what are you cast down, mad priest?" said Richard. "Are you afraid that your diocesan should learn how truly you do serve Our Lady and Saint Dunstan? Tuh, man, fear it not. Richard of England betrays no secrets that pass over the flagon." "No, most gracious sovereign," answered the hermit, well known to the curious in penny histories of Robin Hood by the name of Friar Tuck. "It is not the crozier I fear, but the sceptre, alas, that my sacrilegious fist should have ever been applied to the ear of the Lord's anointed." "Ha!" said Richard. "Sits the wind there? Ha! In truth, I'd forgotten the buff, though my ear sang after it for a whole day. But if the cuff was fairly given, I will be judged by the good men around
if it was not as well repaid, or if you think I still owe you anything, and will stand forth for another counter hit. By no means, replied Friar Tuck. I had my own returned and with usury. May your majesty ever pay your debts as fully. If I could do so with cuffs, said the king, my creditors should have little reason to complain of an empty exchequer. And yet, said the friar, resuming his demure, hypocritical countenance, I know not what penance I ought to perform for that most sacrilegious blow. Oh, speak no more of it, brother, said the king. After having stood so many cuffs from paynims and misbelievers, I were void of reason to quarrel with the buffet of a clerk so holy as he of Copmanhurst. No, my honest friar, I think it would be best both for the church and yourself that I should procure a license to unfrock you and retain you as a yeoman of our guard, serving in care of our person as formerly in attendance upon the altar of St. Dunstan. My liege, said the friar, I humbly crave your pardon, and you would readily grant me excuse did you but know how the sin of laziness has beset me. St. Dunstan, may he be gracious to us, stands quite in his niche, though I should forget my orisons in killing a fat buck. I stay out of my cell sometimes, a night, doing I what not what. St. Dunstan never complains, quite master he is, and a peaceful, as ever was made of wood. But to be a yeoman in attendance on my sovereign, the king, oh, the honour is great, doubtless, yet if I were but to step aside to comfort a widow in one corner, or to kill a deer in another, it would be, where is the dog priest, says one. Who has seen the accursed tuck, says another. The unfrocked villain destroys more venison than half the country besides, says one keeper. And is hunting after every shy doe in the country, quoth a second. In fine good, my liege, I pray you leave me as you found me. Or if in aught you desire to extend your benevolence to me, that I may be considered as the poor clerk of St. Dunstan's cell in Copmanhurst, to whom any small donation will be most thankfully acceptable. I understand you, said the king, and the holy clerk shall have a grant of Verton venison in my woods of Warncliffe. Mark, however, I will but assign you 3 bucks every season, but if that does not prove an apology for your slaying 30, I am no Christian knight nor true king. Your grace may be well assured, said the friar, that with the grace of St. Dunstan I shall find the way of multiplying your most bounteous gift. I nothing doubt it, good brother, said the king, and as venison is but dry food, our sailorer shall have orders to deliver you a butt of sack, a runlet of Malvoisie, and 3 hogsheads of ale of the first strike, yearly. And if that will not quench your thirst, you must come to court and become acquainted with my butler. But for St. Dunstan, said the friar, a cope, a stole, and an altar cloth shall also be there for you, continued the king, crossing himself. But we may not turn our game into earnest, lest God punish us for thinking more on our follies than on his honour and worship. I will answer for my patron, said the priest joyously. Answer for yourself, friar, said King Richard, something sternly, but immediately stretching out his hand to the hermit. The latter, somewhat abashed, bent his knee and saluted it. You do less honour to my extending palm than to my clenched fist, said the monarch. You did only kneel to the one, and to the other you prostrated yourself. But the friar, afraid perhaps of again giving offence by continuing the conversation in too joking a style, a false step to be particularly guarded against by those who converse with monarchs, instead he bowed profoundly and fell into the rear. And at the same time, 2 additional personages appeared on the scene. Chapter 41. The newcomers were Wilfred of Ivanhoe and the prior of Botolph's palfrey, and Garth, who attended him, on the knight's own war horse. The astonishment of Ivanhoe was beyond bounds when he saw his master besprinkled with blood and 6 or 7 dead bodies lying around in the little glade in which the battle had taken place. Nor was he less surprised to see Richard surrounded by so many Sylvan attendants, the outlaws as they seemed to be of the forest, and a perilous retinue therefore for a prince. He hesitated whether to address the king as the Black Knight Errant, or in what other manner to demean himself towards him, and Richard saw his embarrassment. Fear not, Wilfred, he said, to address Richard Plantagenet as himself, since you see him in the company of true English hearts, although it may be they have been urged a few steps aside by warm English blood. Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe, said the gallant outlaw, stepping forward, my assurances can add nothing to those of our sovereign, yet let me say somewhat proudly that of men who have suffered much, he has no truer subjects than those who now stand around him. I cannot doubt it, brave man, said Wilfred, since you are of the number, but what means these marks of death and danger, these slain men, and the bloodied armour of my prince? Ah, treason has been with us, Ivanhoe, said the king, but thanks to these brave men, treason has met its end, but now I bethink me you too are a traitor, said Richard, smiling, a most disobedient traitor, for were not our orders positive that you should repose yourself at St. Boltolf's until the wound is healed? It is healed, said Ivanhoe. It is not of more consequence than the scratch of a bodkin. But why, oh why, noble prince, will you thus vex the hearts of your faithful servants and expose your life by lonely journeys and rash adventures as if it were of no more value than that of a mere knight-errant who has no interest on earth but what lance and sword may procure him? And Richard Plantagenet, said the king, desires no more fame than his good lance and sword may acquire him, and Richard Plantagenet is prouder of achieving an adventure with only his good sword and his good arm to speed than if he led to battle a host of 100,000 armed men. But your kingdom, my liege, said Ivanhoe, your kingdom is threatened with dissolution, with civil war, your subjects menaced with every species of evil. If deprived of their sovereign in some of these dangers which it is your daily pleasure to incur, and from which you have but this moment narrowly escaped, my kingdom and my subjects, answered Richard impatiently, I tell you, Sir Wilfred, the best of them are most willing to repay my follies in kind. For example, my very faithful servant, Wilfred of Ivanhoe, will not obey my positive commands, and yet he reads his king a homily because he does not walk exactly by his advice. Which of us has most reason to upbraid the other? Anyway, forgive me, my faithful Wilfred, the time I have spent and am yet to spend in concealment is, as I explained to you at St. Botolph's, necessary to give my friends and faithful nobles time to assemble their forces, that when Richard's return is announced, he should be at the head of such a force as enemies shall tremble to face, and thus subdue the meditated treason without even unsheathing a sword. Estoteville and Bowen will not be strong enough to move forward to York for 24 hours. I must have news of Salisbury from the south, and Beauchamp in Warwickshire, and of Moulton and Percy in the north. The Chancellor must make sure of London. Too sudden an appearance would be to subject me to dangers other than my lance and sword, though backed by the bow of Bold Robin or the quarter-staff of Friar Tuck and the horn of the sage Womba may be able to rescue me from. Wilfred bowed in submission, well knowing how vain it was to contend with the wild spirit of chivalry which so often impelled his master upon dangers which he might easily have avoided, or rather, which it was unpardonable in him to have sought out. The young knight sighed before, and then held his peace, while Richard rejoiced at having silenced his counsellor, though his heart acknowledged the justice of the charge he had brought against him, and he went on in conversation with Robin Hood. King of outlaws, he said, have you no refreshment to offer your brother sovereign? For these dead knaves have found me both in exercise and appetite. In truth, replied the outlaw, for I scorn to lie to your grace, our larder is chiefly supplied... He stopped, and was somewhat embarrassed. With venison, I suppose, said Richard gaily. Better food at need there can be none. And truly, if a king will not remain at home and slay his own game, methinks he should not brawl too loud if he finds it killed to his hand. If your grace, then, said Robin, will again honour with your presence one of Robin Hood's places of rendezvous, the venison shall not be lacking in a stoup of ale, and it may be a cup of reasonably good wine to relish it withal. The outlaw accordingly led the way, followed by the buxom monarch, more happy probably in this chance meeting with Robin Hood and his foresters than he would have been in again assuming his royal state and presiding over a splendid circle of peers and nobles. Novelty in society and adventure were the zest of life to Richard Coeur de Lion, and it had its highest relish when enhanced by dangers encountered and surmounted. In The Lion-Hearted King, the brilliant but useless character of a knight of romance was in a great measure realised and revived, and the personal glory which he acquired by his own deeds of arms was far more dear to his excited imagination than that which a course of policy and wisdom would have spread around his government. Accordingly, his reign was like the course of a brilliant and rapid meteor which shoots along the face of heaven, shedding around an unnecessary and portentous light which is instantly swallowed up by universal darkness. His feats of chivalry furnishing themes for bards and minstrels, but affording none of those solid benefits to his country on which history loves to pause and hold up as an example to posterity. But in his present company, Richard showed to the greatest imaginable advantage. He was a gay, good-humoured man, fond of every rank of life that sat with him. Beneath a huge oak tree, the sylvan repast was hastily prepared for the King of England, surrounded by men, outlaws to his government, but who now formed his court and his guard. As the flagon went round, the rough foresters soon lost their awe for the presence of majesty. The song and the jest were exchanged. The stories of former deeds were told with advantage, and at length, while boasting of their successful infraction of the laws, no one recollected they were speaking in the presence of their natural guardian. The merry king, nothing heeding his dignity any more than his company, laughed, quaffed, and jested among the jolly band. The natural and rough sense of Robin Hood led him to be desirous that the scene should be closed ere anything should occur to disturb its harmony, the more especially that he observed Ivanhoe's brow clouded with anxiety. "We are honoured," he said to Ivanhoe, apart, "by the presence of our gallant sovereign, yet I would not that he dallied with time, which the circumstances of his kingdom may render precious." "It is well and wisely spoken, brave Robin Hood," said Wilfred apart, "and know, moreover, that they who jest with majesty, even in its gayest mood, are but toying with the lion's whelp, which on slight provocation uses both fangs and claws." "You have touched the very cause of my fear," said the outlaw. "My men are rough by practice and nature. The king is hasty as well as good-humoured, nor know I how soon cause of offence may arise, or how warmly it may be received. It is time this revel was broken off." "It must be by your management, then, gallant yeoman," said Ivanhoe, "for each hint I have essayed to give him serves only to induce him to prolong it." "Must I so soon risk the pardon and favour of my sovereign?" said Robin Hood, pausing for an instant. "But by St. Christopher, it shall be so. I were undeserving his grace did I not peril it for his good. Here, Scathlock, get you behind yonder thicket, and blow me a Norman blast on your bugle, and without an instant's delay, on peril of your life." Scathlock obeyed his captain, and in less than 5 minutes the revellers were startled by the sound of his horn. "It is the bugle of Malvoisin," said the miller, starting to his feet and seizing his bow. The friar dropped the flagon and grasped his quarterstaff. Womba stopped short in the midst of a jest and betook himself to sword and target. All the others stood ready to their weapons. Well, things are moving on apace. We'll see what happens next week with Ivanhoe, Robin Hood, and, of course, Coeur de Lion, the King of England, not to mention Womba and Garth. Until next week, Braidwood, keep safe, and I hope the rain has benefited people. Take care.